So this diagram shows you how the early French town plans, these were called bastide, B-A-S-T-I-D-E, a bastide. The early French town plans, you can see a few of these still in France. They're rather interesting, especially in the south of France and the southwest. And they're more or less on a grid plan, but they're usually up on an elevated level. The rectangular plans, they go all the way back to the Greeks. The Italian garden, which is a very geometrical one, as is the early French gardens, and there's the French hunting forest. You see it up there, third from the left. And then finally, Renaissance Rome. And you can see that those feed directly into Versailles, the town and the park, and Evelyn's plan for London, and then finally all of that flows into the plan for Washington. And there were many other cities besides these that were influenced by these plans. But that gives you a pretty good genealogy, I think, of the Baroque city. Not that they're all the same, you see, but they all share this use of these various techniques and plans in order to look grand, to look powerful, and at the same time, I think there are certain, it's not all decoration, there are certain conveniences as well. All right, so this is Paris. An 18th century proposed plan for Paris and the what's called the Île-de-France, which is this little area here in the cutout at the top. And there's something similar in Rome. It's called the Tiberine Island. It's an island formed by, you know, mud accumulations in the past that the river flows around. And both of them are sort of in the form of a boat. And in the case of Paris, this was the original Roman settlement was on that island. All right, and so in the 18th century, a mapmaker and theorist had an idea for actually replacing Notre Dame Cathedral, which is right there, with a classical building, classical church. Gulp, glad he didn't do it. This is Nancy in the north of France. And you can see here we have, again, this vista with a statue at the center. And this will be very true of both Renaissance Rome and of Louis XIV's Paris and his Versailles. But you also see these curved arms here, which were inspired by the colonnade in front of St. Peter's. And in Paris, you'll see later on, there's something very similar. Here, there's a triumphal arch here that leads to another square. And in fact, if you reverse this a little bit, what do you get but the Louvre in Paris here, feeding through a little arch that was not a Baroque creation at all. It's the arch of the Carousel, which was built rather later than our period. And it goes through a park that once had a palace right here called the Tuileries Paris, a palace. So this separated the Tuileries Paris, a palace, which was, by the way, torn down by revolutionaries in the 1850s. It was burned down. It was one of the residences of the king. And and still in modern-day Paris, this is the Tuileries Gardens, which stretch all the way out to here. And when you get to the end, you get to a square called the Place de la Concorde. And in the middle of this is an obelisk, and there are buildings all around and a whole lot of traffic because it's a roundabout. Were you to continue further down this street, you would go down a long, broad boulevard called the Boulevard of the Great Army, and that leads you through to the Champs-Élysées, and then past that to the Arc de Triomphe, the great monumental triumphal arch that Napoleon had built. So we're in the 19th century by then. But you can see at this imitation of that style at Nancy, you can see that a northern French city then was influenced by the Parisian model. The Parisian model, in turn, was influenced by the model of Versailles and the model of Rome. So let's move on a little bit. We're going to look at two things, and two things only. One is the Piazza del Popolo. How many of you have been to Rome? Just out of curiosity. Oh, a lot of people. Okay. Well, you may well know where that is. It's the westernmost gate. It's a central western gate, the city of Rome. And it was a prominent entrance to the city. And by the, we'll see this later, by the mid-17th century, it was a bit of a mess. In fact, the reason it got cleaned up was because Queen Christina of Sweden, who converted to Roman Catholicism and abdicated the throne in Sweden, by the way, she had been a patroness of no less a person than René Descartes, Gulf. He caught cold going up to Sweden and died. But in any case, they didn't want Queen Christina to come into Rome through this crowded and not very attractive plaza, and so they redid it just for her. And we'll see how that works in a bit. All I want you to notice here is this, and I'm sorry about the order of things here, but I'll try to make sure you can keep these things in chronological order by posting them on Blackboard later in the right order, okay? There are three streets here. One of the main streets of Rome, the Via del Corso, right here. If you go all the way down that street, by the way, you'll get to the monument of Vittorio Emanuele. It's a straight street, goes all the way down. Over here, the Via del Babuino, the baboon street. I won't explain that to you. There is an explanation. Over here, the Via di Rispetti. So there are three streets, and they are sort of like a bird's foot. One goes straight back, the other two go at angles like this. You notice there is a church facade right here. Now, the Renaissance world loved symmetry, but the Baroque world used symmetry too, just in an odd way. And what happens here, among other things, is that there's an obelisk in the center of this plaza. And Pope Alexander III had one of his architects then demolish this house and put a matching church over here. And I'll find my photographs in a minute. I'm going to put it down. The trick here is, I've been in both these churches many times because I lived in Rome for a couple of years. And
huh? Actually, I could never get into that one.
Oh, you couldn't? Oh, well, when I was living in Italy in the mid-70s, things were closed permanently, or if they were open, they were open at hours that nobody could ever frequent. But I put a church over here to match this one. The thing is that the ground plan is not the same for the two churches. So there's a total illusion of symmetry here. And you'll find this a lot in Baroque building practice. All right, so we're looking at the Piazza del Popolo over here. See, and there's this radiating bird's foot design. Now, this was the first of these, and you'll start seeing them a lot because the Piazza del Popolo had quite an impact on subsequent design. There's a very interesting obelisk right here. Now, there are lots of obelisks in Rome. Most of them were brought over from Egypt. You have to admire the Romans for being able to ship a huge monolithic piece of carved stone like this and bring it all the way across the Mediterranean. What Sixtus V did in the 1590s was to have his architect, Domenico Fontana, take up the medieval plan of Rome, as it were, and make it into a streamlined modern city. Now, medieval Rome and early Renaissance Rome was a place of pilgrimage. And so people came to Rome and they went to all the great historic basilicas. So St. John Lateran, Santa Maria Maggiore, St. Mary Major, St. Paul Outside the Walls, St. Peter's, of course, and so on and so forth. But getting to these churches, and by the way, one of your essays tells you that there were crowded conditions for tourists and pilgrims and travelers, and Sixtus, by the end of the 16th century, became concerned about all of this, and so he had these straight streets opened up. He bought property. Again, one of your essays, I think, tells you about this, does it not? And the Pope, who, by the way, ruled Rome as a secular ruler and not just as a religious ruler, they had all sorts of compensation and this and that and the other. They demolished houses, but the way they made these paths into streets was by creating or forcing the owners to create uniform facades. So they regulated the facades of the houses and palaces and usually houses. You lived on what we would call the second floor, which they call the first floor. And then you had shops below and a door in the middle. And this goes all the way back to Roman times. This is the way Roman shops were handled. They were on the ground floor, and then the entrance to the house proper was up a grand staircase to the second floor. So they decreed that all the facades had to follow certain very precise architectural decoration. And you'll see that in Rome today. It's still there. What this does is to de-emphasize the individual character of the buildings along the street and place more emphasis on the street. Now, interesting enough, Baron Usman in the 1860s, when he redid Paris in very much the same fashion, although when he cut the great boulevards through, he didn't have pilgrimage churches for them to lead to. He did very much the same thing. So if you go to Paris, the historic part of Paris, you'll see these buildings all have the same facade designs. They're all very uniform. And in fact, you can look at this two ways. Most people find it attractive and harmonious and beautiful. And some people long for the good old mishmash, picturesque, cheek by jowl, this and that and the other sort of city design that just grows organically whichever way it might. But that's where that design comes from. It comes from the plans of Domenico Fontana and Sixtus V. The idea was that each of the piazzas would have an obelisk in its center, and usually there was a monument then in that piazza. And you be able to go down these straight streets all the way to the monument, to the church, say Santa Maria Maggiore, you want to visit. The obelisk is tall, so it stands as a kind of arrow marker. And by the way, these obelisks, you know where they were used by the Romans? They were the goalposts in the arenas when they had chariot races. So the tela, you know, the goal. So they were erected all over Rome, and now you had chariots, of course. They were starting to use chariots in Rome, and these streets, they became very fashionable places to parade up and down in the 17th century. So there are two popes to bear in mind, who are especially important. Sixtus the Fifth. I've always found that kind of odd, you know, the Sixth, Fifth, but anyway. And then Alexander the Seventh. Kind of confusing, isn't it? The Sixth, Five, and Alexander the Seventh. But anyway, Alexander the Seventh put the crowning touches on this modernization, or barroquization, if you want to call it that, of Rome. By Alexander the Seventh's time, this is, of course, the 1750s, a good 60 or so years later, Rome was no longer a political presence of any note. It was, by this time, a cultural center. This was the fate of a number of Italian cities. It was the fate of Venice. It was the fate of Florence by this time. Rome was heavily sustained by tourism. So was Venice. So was Florence. Some things don't change much, do they? So Sixtus V had various motives for this plan that he established. It was not completed during his lifetime. Most of these plans take not years, but decades, sometimes even centuries to implement. So you have to bear that in mind in this period. You don't go through demolishing houses and straightening out streets overnight, although Baron Osman in the 19th century managed to do things with surprising speed and also with some opposition, as you can imagine. All right, so here is the Tiber. And since rivers, many rivers, refuse to flow in a straight path, the Tiber gives you something of a problem to plan around, as I discovered every time I took my car into Rome. Now, this is the Piazza del Popolo as it looks today. And you see the two churches. And if you look very closely, you'll notice that the one on the right, here's the one on the left, the one on the right is just a dome. It's probably not in use for services now, by the way, I just suspect. All right, so here's the gate, the Porta del Popolo, of the people, and there's your goalpost. This was a 19th century addition to the piazza, so it wasn't a Baroque feature. But you notice it does, in its curved arms, it does echo, again, Bernini's colonnade that we'll see in the Vatican. Okay. This is Bernini's colonnade in the Vatican before St. Peter's. So the 19th century pattern is an echo of St. Peter's. Well, St. Peter's is an interesting case. The great basilica itself was established by Constantine. And so it goes all the way back to the very early period when Rome had become Christian for the first time, and Constantine built various basilicas at St. John Lateran and St. Peter's all over Rome. Julius II, you remember him, did you ever see, what was the Charles
the
Nestor?
The Agony and Ecstasy.
Yeah, the Agony and the Ecstasy. Julius II was this somewhat egomaniac pope who did something that you would suppose would have been unthinkable. He actually demolished old St. Peter's, this ancient church, to build a bigger one. And we have images. This may be 1500, but believe me, it's the beginning of the I am a monument Baroque movement. And because it takes things so long, you can say that the rebuilding of St. Peter's is probably the first step towards the Baroque as we know it. Now, originally, St. Peter's was to be built by an architect who was an uncle of Raphael's, by the way, by the name of Bramante. And his original plan was that St. Peter's would be a central church. It would have a circular plan. But they got going with the first stage of it, and then it stopped and started and stopped. In short, it took 100 years, over 100 years, to finish St. Peter's in the remodel from start to finish. So there was when Bernini got started on this, there were supposed to be 2 bell towers, one here and one here. And they discovered that they built one and it started to crumble, so they took it down. They couldn't bear the weight. But Bernini built his colonnade. This is a very Baroque idea. And again, you can see this combination of the circle and the rectangle or the square as a kind of Baroque motif. This obelisk originally stood over here because this is where Nero's circus was. And you know, the circus is a kind of oblong affair for running chariots. I've discovered that optical mice do not like formica. Word to the wise.
You have the laser thing on the other.
Yeah, I do, don't I? I can use that instead. So, I forget where it is. There it is. I showed everybody else where this was. And so. Hello? Oh, no, that's the menu. Wait a minute.
It's up on the right-hand corner, I think.
Oh, yeah, there it is. That's the other remote. I run through about 12 remotes a day lately. Okay, there. So over here was Nero's circus. And St. Peter was buried in a cemetery that was right adjacent to this circus. And this obelisk was over here at one of the goals of the circus. During the 16th century, this obelisk was moved completely by hand, a remarkable bit of engineering, from here over to in front of St. Peter's.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. As a matter of fact, St. Peter's tomb is below the high altar, and they assumed that it was always said that St. Peter's tomb was below the high altar. It's not absolutely certain, but excavations in the 20th century seem to point to the very strong likelihood that that is the case. So that was built on top of a cemetery, and that was one of the reasons why we think that that must indeed be where the high altar is because it was very serious to desecrate a cemetery by building on top of it in the ancient world. So, you know, it seems very likely that they had to have a very serious reason for doing that. You can go down to the grottos underneath there and see all the ancient Roman tombs. Oh, no, I don't want that. Ah, go away. Okay, so perfectly lined up here. Michelangelo had a hand in the redesign. By the way, the reason they didn't want a circular design for the church was because it wasn't good for processions. And it's interesting, my daughter is getting married this spring. She went around looking for a church that had an aisle, a central aisle. She said, who wants to walk in like this with everybody looking at you? You're supposed to spring out of nowhere suddenly in your bridal regalia. And she has a point. At least it was shared by the ecclesiastics who were looking at the redesign of St. Peter's. This is what it looks like as it was going up. We're seeing St. Peter's from behind, and from the back of part of the Vatican Palace. And you see people standing on the roof there, but it's not complete. Now, this answers your question. You see that rectangular facade that looks somewhat like a kind of temple entrance? That's Old St. Peter's. But that's the porch of Old St. Peter's. And Old St. Peter's also had a series of arched colonnade that ran all the way around. So this is New St. Peter's swallowing up Old St. Peter's. And this is the moving of the obelisk right here from the side. But it also gives you a good view of Old St. Peter's and New St. Peter's under construction. So there's a whole lot of architecture going on here in 1586. And it's only a year or two later that Sixtus V then will begin his plans for the replanting of Rome. This is Old St. Peter's in an early 17th century engraving. And you see the colonnade on one side. By the way, you see that strange thing here in the middle? This was a pine cone of bronze. It's very tall. It's about 10 feet tall. It's now to be seen in the colonnade of the Vatican. You can see it from the Vatican Museum when you cross from one to the other. It was the other goalpost. The obelisk was one goalpost, and the pine cone was the other. Anyway, it once stood in the center there, and it was replaced by the obelisk as a grander marker for the piazza in front. So here is, this is what I was describing. This is the arena where they had the chariot races. Is Old St. Peter's. And then New St. Peter's started here. Goes all the way around here. Can you see the outline of New St. Peter's? Okay. This is the palace behind. And again, this you saw this a little bit closer up before. Out behind, there is a hill going all the way up. And on the top of that was the Belvedere, which was a medieval palace that the popes lived in. Towards the end of the 16th century, then the popes built the Quirinal Palace. This is over to the north where the Via Pia is, that leads to the Porta Pia. And there they constructed a Renaissance-style palace. But then the Belvedere, which was Bramante's doing, is this steeped affair that tells you very clearly what it means to say that Baroque architecture becomes more and more dominated by the theatrical. By the way, this is all torn down now. But it is part of the Vatican Museum. And so the pine cone that you'll see up here at one part of the Vatican Museum, when you're walking across from one part of it to the other, you'll see that pine cone. It's located about up here. And then the Vatican Palace is back there. And then the Vatican Gardens are back around here and on the other side. Those horses are a little bit out of proportion, I think, by the way. Okay. That's as far as I got with that before the great crash. Let's hope that my crash was the only crash we'll experience this year. And I don't mean computers. Let's see. Did I close them? I thought I had all those things open. Did I close them? Okay, back to no name. Well, let's see. Is it this one? So, Alexander VII, then, his Domenico Fontana was Gian Lorenzo Bernini, and you'll hear a lot about him next time. He was an architect, he was a sculptor, he was one of the greatest sculptors in the history of art, and one of the great architectural designers and builders. And Bernini's original plan was that the colonnade, remember the old St. Peter's had this rectilinear colonnade, this colonnade then was meant to symbolize the church embracing the world. Today, when you go to Rome and you look down the, especially if you go up the stairs to above St. Peter's and look out over the facade down to the piazza and beyond it, you see this long street, the Via della Conciliazione, that goes all the way to the Tiber River. That was the 20th century creation. In the 1920s, as a result of a concordat between Mussolini and the then reigning Pope, which finally settled the status of the Vatican, and it became a separate state within the city, within the state. Originally, Bernini had, you know that the colonnade comes to a stop on either side about here. Originally, there was to be another shorter piece of colonnade here with two openings, because beyond it was the whole medieval neighborhood, the Borgo. The Borgo is a little town or a neighborhood. And so that was very different, because Bernini's idea, and all this architecture is highly symbolic, was that you would wander through these warrens of medieval streets like a lost soul, and then suddenly this wide open space, this grand space with statues at the top that look like they're life size, but are actually twice life size. They're so far up and away. This entire scene, as you penetrated the quadruple range of columns, it suddenly bursts before your eyes. And so that is very much a Baroque effect. Surprise is one of the great features of Baroque planning and architecture. And this, by the way, in case I forget to mention it, is true also of 18th century gardening theory. Gardening during the 17th century was more or less along geometrical lines. But in the 18th century, under Chinese influence, believe it or not, the natural garden movement that began in England and then spread to France and all over Europe saw, well, we wouldn't think of these gardens as very natural these days. They're still planned and designed, but they were planned and designed to look natural. So when I say the city moves from being a fortress to being a theater and then to being a garden, the garden that the city will become ultimately will be rather more like a 17th century garden than an 18th century garden. The 18th century garden returned back to the idea of surprise and the unexpected and so on. But anyway, 18th century gardens were full of things like carved quotations from great poets, and they would mark lookout points. An overview of the landscape in these gardens. And there you would have the pleasure of contemplating a landscape while you read a matching quotation from a classical author, say Horace, or maybe a citation from Virgil, something of this sort. So Baroque architecture also is a very literary architecture. It's a highly symbolic architecture. It's meant to suggest in its breaking of lines that nothing man creates is solid. Nothing man creates will last. On the one hand, the paradox is that what man creates can also be grand, and in fact, the architect can look like a kind of deity who creates a world even out of nothing, that is, out of an idea. Well, as we look at the impact Alexander VII and Bernini's planning, we're right at the cusp of the beginning of something similar in France. Now, up to the 1650s, there is a French Baroque that is nascent in the early half of the 17th century, and this idea of the Great Plaza begins, in fact, early enough with King Henry IV, who was assassinated in the first years of the 17th century, but who created the Place des Vosges, which is still there. And this is an early example of a large Parisian square that will give rise, then, in French fashion, to a large number of French squares, or places, as they're called in French. Paris was a problem for Louis XIV, as a matter of fact. The residence for most of the monarchs, or the main residence, had been the Louvre, which now we know is a museum. And I had one of the things that crashed, that I lost in my computer, that I didn't really lose, was the set of slides that I had digitized earlier today to show you. These are slides I shot back in 1971 and 2, I think. And some of them are still here. So if I can find the top of this, I will show you something. I'm not going to say too much about Paris other than to note that the Louvre was expanded under Louis XIV to become the place that we see today. It was made into a quadra. It had several wings added to it. This activity continues all through the 18th century as well, and well into the reign of Louis XV, his grandson. But Louis XIV came to rule after a series of revolts and threats by the nobility during his his childhood and his infancy, before his regency, before he was able to become king as a mature adult. And he was constantly concerned about the power of the Fronde, which is a French word that means resistance. So his father, Louis XIII, had built a palace in a small village not too far to the west of Paris called Versailles. And there he decided to move his court. And this is a very clever plan, and I would say a very Baroque one too, because it allowed him to consolidate his power for this reason. One way to reduce the power of the nobility is to make them subservient in every way to the monarch. And he did that, first of all, by giving them little tasks, like attending him at bedtime and attending him when he woke up. And it was a very high honor, in fact, to, say, take his robe in the evening, so on and so forth. These are, as you might imagine, fairly ritualized and somewhat, we would think, public bedtimes, but that's the way it is with kids. To further control them and to break, if not their spirits, certainly their pocketbooks, he moved the whole court to Versailles. This meant that they had to have a house in Paris and a house in Versailles, because they were going to spend most of their time in Versailles. And it was the beginning of a scheme that he and his minister, Colbert, developed to use the arts, and by the way, especially architecture, but not architecture alone, poetry, music, painting, sculpture, all this to aggrandize the power of the monarch. In the course of all this, then, he built a palace, a royal residence, that was so grandiose that it became, you might say, the benchmark for all royal palaces all over Europe. And at this point with Versailles, we get the convergence then of the Baroque architectural symbolism of power and all the techniques, as we'll see in a moment. But at the same time, when the French take hold of the Baroque, they reclassicize it. And so the French Baroque is really a newly classicized Baroque. And this was, you know, the French kind of like to do this from time to time to show people that they still have a lot of cultural power. I'm kind of half French, so I say that with my tongue in cheek. But what Louis XIV did then was to say, France rules. Not just I rule, not just l'état c'est moi, I am the state, but France is the most powerful nation in Europe. And certainly by this time there were, he had reason to be able to take advantage of certain problems other nations were having politically and otherwise. All right, so Versailles. This is a slide taken with the chateau in silhouette. Oh, that's right, this isn't PowerPoint anymore, draft. At the back of the chateau are the gardens, and you have this tremendous vista that goes down a long lawn. There are forested walkways on either side, statues that line it all along the way, and this huge canal that also goes way back over to here and over to here on either side. And down here below is a twice as big as life statue of Neptune in his chariot with tritons and porpoises and other conveying animals, you might say, of the deep. Now, this is interesting. What is it doing here? As you enter the gate, where's the gate just coming down the road? There it is. Okay. Sorry about that. As you enter the gate, you see over it the emblem of the Sun King over the main gate. And behind it, then, is a long, straight street. These straight streets were especially important for ceremonial purposes, for corteges, for parades, for all kinds of secular rituals as well as religious rituals. And in a domain as highly ritualized as Louis XIV's France, this was especially important. Now, let's see. I said that that canal goes over to the side. There's some young guy there with a camera and much darker hair than he has now. I had a movie camera with 400-foot reels on it and two 35-millimeter cameras and a whole bunch of stuff with me because I wanted to take pictures that I'd be able to use for lectures. Little thinking that over... How long has that been? 38 years later, I would still be using them. And I have to say they're in pretty good shape. Whoops, that's the Grand Trianon. One of the places that Louis XIV built to retire to when he was sick and tired of all the ceremony. Let's see. Here he is. Okay, here's what we want. So the chateau has a central main body and then two very large monumental wings on either side. And there's an equestrian statue in the center. I believe this is actually Louis XV, isn't it? I think it's Louis XIV, but I think it's actually his grandson. Now, let's see. standing at the statue and looking back, and you can see straight down the street, this is the Sun King emblem up here. I know this doesn't look very big, but in fact it's quite large, this gate. And you'd stand about at the top of the there. Person is standing about there at the top of that cross. Okay. And here you're looking down the street, and out there are stables and various other buildings here along the way. And army barracks and all sorts of things. On the other hand, you notice with the wings coming out like this from the chateau, you get, again, a kind of... well, this reminds me of the Place des Vosges that Henry IV built, as a matter of fact, which was a whole square that had similar wings. But at the same time, it's interesting, if Bernini's church embraced in semicircles, Louis XIV does so rectangularly. But as a matter of fact, Bernini was called to Louis XIV's court from Italy to design a facade for the Louvre. And later, he submitted designs for the Chateau at Versailles, none of which were accepted. This was not so much because Bernini's commission failed, but because there were many rivals, and I think the French architects didn't want any Italian building their magnificent royal chateau. And so they formed a cabal and did various things to make sure that Bernini would not get the final design. Here we go. So this young lady in the red dress, that, who seemed to pop up in most of my slides when I was at Versailles. No, I was not pursuing her. So this is on the other side of the statue, the equestrian statue, just to give you a sense of scale. So it's quite immense. And you hear people standing in line to get in the ticket office over here. You see where they are? Their heads are about the top of the crossbar of the plus sign. Now, in addition to the chateau, there are also the gardens. And the gardens were among, well, were certainly the largest of their kind in Europe. There had been others, and in fact, there was a Vaux-le-Vicomte, a noble there, had such a fine palace and such fine, well, actually a minister there had such a fine, Fouquet, had such a fine palace and gardens that when he invited Louis XIV to his estate to give him a properly lavish welcome, Louis XIV looked around and immediately said, "We have to get rid of this man. He's too powerful." And he was sure that he built gardens in Versailles that were far more extensive than any that had been built in France up to that time. And indeed, they are pretty breathtaking. So if you walk towards that canal where the fountain is and look back at the palace, and you see these little figures of people up here, and this long promenade going to it. Actually, the Neptune statue is just at my back as I'm standing here. You get a sense of the scale and size. And let's see, moving right along. Here we are, even further back, as the chateau, the rear facade of the chateau, you see. And this is all one large monumental staircase going up from here. And there are multiple levels to the left and the right in these areas beyond the trees. Here. No, that's the front. There. And there is the fountain statue of Neptune in his chariot. No, those are horses, but there's some sea monsters around over here and about, so we know for sure it's Neptune. Poseidon. So this is where, for sure, if theater met architecture early in Italy, this is where the theatrical is practiced on a systematic basis. Everywhere you turn in Versailles, every perspective then leads you to your sense of the presence of a powerful man at the center of this architecture and this entire operation. One of the ways that this was adopted all over Europe was in the rather smaller princedoms of the German-speaking world. And so you get these Herzogs and others who built imitation Versailles in the course of the 18th century and well into the 19th century, all the way up to Ludwig the Mad, who you may recall was a patron of Wagner's. They built these huge, expensive, and sometimes ruinous works of architecture to vie with the example that Louis XIV had set. Now, you may recall that in some of the essays, there was mention of influence not only as far as Washington, but even well into the 20th century from the Baroque city. And I think the truth of the matter is that the modern city, which is really the next stage beyond the Baroque, nevertheless still bears many of the marks of the Baroque city. Not only Washington, D.C. By the way, do you realize that Washington, D.C. was a rather pitiful idea of a capital until after the Civil War. When Charles Dickens visited the United States, he went to Washington and he thought the city was ludicrous in its pretensions because it had the Capitol and the White House and all that, and then some muddy streets and nothing else. What made Washington into a big capital city, not in original size because the property had been established for the District of Columbia, but what made it what it is today was business. Originally, Washington was supposed to be a capital. By the way, Washington was the first capital built specifically for governmental purposes. But the reason that it expanded after the Civil War was not because it attracted a lot of businesses. This is the original idea, that the government would be supported by the commerce that would be cultivated there, since people would naturally want to be near the seat of federal power. Well, it didn't happen for a very, very long time, and so Washington was a few magnificent but rather isolated-looking buildings that were in a sort of large area adjacent to a swamp. The business that put Washington on the map a second time was a business of big government. And it wasn't really until practically the turn of the century, the 20th century, that is, around 1900, that Washington started to grow really rapidly and become a capital city worth the name. It was also at this time, by the way, that Washington implemented fully, or if not fully, more fully, Pierre L'Enfant's plan. Because Pierre L'Enfant's plan had not really been followed for quite a long time. A commission was drawn up at the end of the 19th century to give Washington, or to redo Washington in a variant of L'Enfant's original plan. So the image you saw, the map you saw of L'Enfant's plan at the beginning of all of this is not current-day Washington. Current-day Washington had already been built in a number of places. And so the streets, the diagonal streets, were cut through, and a number of changes were made, and the great vistas were established. And you may wonder, well, how come all of this happened so late? And the answer is that the Baroque city lived on into the industrial era, not simply in the building of and the renovation of old cities and the building of new cities, but also in a phenomenon that began around the 1850s, even the 1830s, and that was the World Expositions. The World Expositions, there was the Crystal Palace in London in 1850. There was, of course, there were a number of World Expositions in Paris. These were places where, among other things, technology and science advances were shown off, and also new products and the rest of this. But it was the new power, the power now of industry and the power of democracy that was being exhibited. And the buildings themselves have exactly the same characteristics as those that characterize Baroque architecture in the Baroque city. Perhaps the real shift comes in 1889, when the Universal Exposition in Paris introduced to these ceremonial fairs on a grand scale two interesting things. One was they brought in natives and they set up exhibits of the colonies abroad. So colonies in Asia, colonies in Africa, colonies in the Americas. They even produced villages that they set up that people could visit. And out of this eventually came the Museum of Ethnography in Paris. But another innovation that was a sheer demonstration of technology, but in its own way a very Baroque demonstration, was the creation out of solid iron of a tall, useless spire called the Eiffel Tower. And that's probably the turning point then in what we think of as the Baroque city. What's interesting is that contemporary with it in our fair city of Chicago in the 1890s, well, to be precise, in 1892, now what do you think that was celebrating? In the Columbian Exposition in Chicago, we got the beginning of the City Beautiful movement. And there the fairgrounds were all in sort of Barocco classical style. It was sometimes called the White City because it was all marble. The Columbian Exposition, it seems to me, is the last stage of the Baroque city. And it was at the time of the Columbian Exposition then that the idea of returning to L'Enfant's model in Washington was floated about and ultimately was brought to fruition. The 20th century has its own form of exhibition of power in the skyscraper, building higher and higher. And that's another story for another time. I think probably in a couple of semesters, isn't it? Now, I'm going to pause now and see if you have any questions about any of the essays or any of the material otherwise or any of this. And I will try to put, I'll select some of the key slides that illustrate the readings most pertinently to put on Blackboard for you. Any questions or comments? No? Oh, one thing I should point out, too, in the 19th century, one of the aspects of city planning nobody ever talks about, but that's very important, is sewerage. what to do with water and waste. And that was not something that they spent a lot of time with in the Baroque period. But when the Prince of Wales, who later became Edward VII, was asked if he were not in line for the throne, what profession he would have liked to have followed, he said he would have liked to have been a plumbing engineer, because as the Baroque city gets transformed into the industrial city, plumbing was the latest thing, and it was associated with health and the curing of and the avoidance of disease. So, you know, it's interesting. One imagines Edward VII could have been designing sewers instead of having mistresses at an advanced age when his mother finally died and he got to ascend to the throne. But that's just an afterthought. No? Any? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, in the Italian Renaissance, in the 16th century, yeah.
Andrea Palladio.
Mm-hmm. Scamozzi. Mm-hmm. Well, there are a number of them that are important, but they're important for different reasons. Palladio certainly had the most influence of all of them. His, first of all, because he produced volumes that were extraordinarily well printed, and he had detailed drawings of the various things he produced. He produced estates, private houses, public buildings, theaters. And it was really the private houses, the palaces and estates, and the villas that were the most influential of his architecture. And so you know, wealthy nobility in England and landed gentry, all of that. The fashion was to have your home built in Palladian style. And there were English Palladian architects who became well known in their own right, who had modified Palladio. What Palladio did was to find a way to use classical motifs without looking classical, altogether classical. You know, he use them to develop a new language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's actually, now Venice is peculiar. The Venetian Renaissance was very different from the Renaissance in the rest of Italy. And there's a Venetian Baroque, but it too is very different from the Baroque in the rest of Italy. So the Doge's Palace dates back to the 14th, 15th centuries. The square, St. Mark's Square, and all of that is really a 16th century design. And you can tell, as a matter of fact, because already there you see the great plaza, you see the open straight street that leads from the Grand Canal across to well, there's the Doge's Palace on the right, and then there's the San Marco past it on the right, and then down to that building with the bell tower that has the Moor and the mechanical figures that come out and sound the hour. These kinds of vistas in Venice are the mark of Renaissance Venice. I have a very interesting book that I bought when I was in Rome that it's called Studies for an Architectural, for an Urban History of Venice. And it goes all the way back to the beginning. And for each period, it has a map that shows what the structures were at that period, all the way back to the 8th century. And it shows how the different neighborhoods, because Venice is really a city of neighborhoods, almost more than a city. It shows how each of these neighborhoods changed from century to century, all the way up to the 19th century. And the last touch in St. Mark's Square was the closing off of the end of the square opposite St. Mark's. And that was done by Napoleon. So it's kind of hard sometimes to say exactly when a particular ensemble began and ended. So the library that's to the left of the big campanile that's opposite the Doge's palace, there's a library there that's in somewhat classical style. That's a Renaissance building. But then there are other churches, domed churches, that are very much Baroque creations. They usually tend not to be so much in the center as on the other islands and some of the other parts of Venice that you get a lot of the Baroque stuff. Well, I had some very nice notes for you that I didn't get a chance to use, so I'll post those on Blackboard too, okay? Just to get a, give you something to fill in with, particularly some of the principal features of Alberti's and Vitruvius's books. But I think we've probably had enough, and you probably have a long way to drive to get home. Be very careful about overpasses and icy streets, as though I needed to tell you that. And I will be too. So I hope you have a safe return home, and we'll see you next week.